Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Saul Landau. He is an award-winning filmmaker of over 40 films. He's producer, director, and writer of the new film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up?, which is screening this Monday, the 22nd of August, at 7:30 in the evening at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I should add that you will be there in person for this screening. This is an amazing documentary. It gives the background to the incarceration of the Cuban Five. Let's just start with that. Who are the Cuban Five, and of what were they convicted?
Well, the Cuban Five were spies. They were spies that were sent from Havana to infiltrate not the U.S. government, but exile groups living in South Florida who were perpetrating acts of violence in Cuba. In other words, these terrorist groups operating out of Miami were bombing Cuban hotels, tourist hotels, restaurants, bars, and clubs. And the Cuban government essentially sent these five guys in to infiltrate, find out what they were doing so they could stop them, because the FBI wasn't doing anything about it. Later on, the FBI arrested them, even though these five were feeding the FBI information about arms caches, explosive caches, and plans of terrorist actions. They arrested them in 1998, and after a while, because they could have charged them with the one crime that they were guilty of, which was failing to register as foreign agents, and the maximum sentence for that would have been 18 months. So far, no one's ever been prosecuted under that law, because the Americans are doing that abroad. So usually they arrest, like, Israeli spies who were arrested on 9/11, and they were immediately deported. They weren't charged. Anyway, they were held for a while, and then they trumped up charges, which were conspiracy to commit espionage. Not committing espionage, because there was no evidence that they had. But they charged them with conspiracy, which is a totally different ballgame. And one of them was charged with aiding and abetting murder, which had to do with the shootdown of two airplanes that were civilian airplanes that were flown over Cuban airspace in February of 1996. Should I get into that story?
No, we'll get into that in a minute, because let's take it back a moment. Because
they were given long, long sentences.
Right. So it's an incredible story, because these folks were convicted of espionage, which wasn't, I mean, conspiracy to commit espionage, but it wasn't against the U.S. government that they were working. It was against U.S.-based terrorists.
Exactly. They were really contributors to U.S. forces in the war against terrorism.
Right, right. Well, let's go back to the Cuban Revolution and the flight of the Miami white, well, the flight of the Cuban white middle class to Miami, business owners, business-owning Cubans. Describe the links between that group of people that fled after the Cuban Revolution and the American government groups into the 1960s.
Well, the first group of Cubans that came over came in 1959, and these were basically the officers, military and police officers, of the dictator Fulgencio Batista, plus some of his loyal, very wealthy supporters. Immediately following came the very upper classes of Cuba, who saw the handwriting on the wall. By mid-1960, the middle classes also saw the handwriting on the wall as the government began to nationalize certain property and make all kinds of rules and regulations that made capitalist enterprise less than, how should I say it, appetizing. And they came over with a singular idea that the U.S. government would simply not permit this to happen and that the U.S. government would solve the problem. That was the basic mentality of the first waves of Cuban immigrants that came to Miami.
And so
the U.S.
What
government welcomed them with open arms. They welcomed people who had tortured and murdered under the Batista government, who had stolen, that is, hijacked airplanes and boats, who had taken money from the Treasury. From the Cuban Treasury, and they all got welcomed when they came to Florida. None of them were charged with any crimes. If you want to go back to why the origins of airplane hijacking. This is essentially when it started. And those some of those same people began to carry out raids into Cuba from South Florida, including overflights and dropping bombs on Cuban territory from bases near Miami.
So what were their links with the American government? In other words, with both the presidential administrations of that time and the covert groups such as the CIA?
Well, up until March of 1960, it was an informal link. I mean, after all, the military people were well-known, indeed trained by U.S. military people. The Cuban intelligence people who came over, the Batista people, were well-known to the CIA. Some of them were CIA agents. But then, in March of 1960, this got formalized when President Eisenhower ordered the CIA to overthrow the Cuban government, the Cuban Revolutionary Government. And a training program began to recruit, first of all, men of fighting age, Cuban exiles, to get trained in order to go back into the island. First, it was going to be a guerrilla war, and then it came to be, later on in 1960, a regular strike force, an invasion force that would hit the beach and take over the island. This was a straight-out U.S. government, Pentagon-CIA combined operation. And this was totally formal, albeit, quote, secret. Secret in the sense that it wasn't made public, but in Miami, this was an open secret. Everybody knew about it. And the New York Times, in fact, published a story about it in early April, a reporter named Tad Schultz. He had even listed, I think few people know this story, Tad told me this story before he died, that he had found out the place of the location where the invasion was going to take place, which was the Bay of Pigs, and the date of the embarkation. And so he had put this in his article. When the New York Times editor read the story, he said, oh, I better check this with the publisher. And he called the publisher and said, should we run this? I mean, the story seems accurate. Schultz has good sources. And the publisher said, let me check with the White House. Remember, this is the New York Times.
Right.
And the publisher called the White House and spoke to President Kennedy. And Kennedy said, well, I think on the grounds of national security, I'd rather you not run those details about where and when. And sure enough, those were essentially excised. They were cut from the story. And so the Schultz story appeared in early April of 1961 without the crucial details. Later on, Kennedy, of course, said, you know, I think I made a mistake. I should have let you publish this story. Then we might have had an excuse to cancel the invasion. But that was the story. So it was known, very well known. The question was where and when. And that would have been known had the Times published it. So the relations were quite formal. The CIA contracted with some 1,500 men. They trained them, plus special brigades that were likened to the Waffen-SS of the Nazis. That is, the brigade that was, after the victory, they were going to go in and clean up, wipe out the pro-Castro groups in town after town, block after block. This was a special group. Some of the terrorists, by the people who became terrorists later, came out of this particular group, who were given extra special training by the CIA.
We're talking to Saul Landau about his film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? One of the things that I was so struck by, and which really kind of speaks volumes about our foreign policy toward Cuba, is that the U.S. government basically opposed the post-revolutionary actions in Cuba to get rid of the mafia. So in other words, U.S. policy was essentially pro-mafia.
Well, the mafia was doing business in Havana. They were playing footsie with the government, as the scene from Godfather 2, which we threw into the movie, shows you.
Right.
It was very accurate. The Cuban government under Batista had forged a partnership with the mafia around gambling and prostitution. And it was a very profitable one for both sides. And after all, these, quote, businessmen, I mean, one of them was a famous actor named George Raft. I think you're probably too young to remember him, but he was a great character actor. He was always a gangster. In the film Some Like It Hot, for example, which is played on Turner Oldies and so on, Raft plays the gangster. Well, he ran the Capri Hotel in Havana, hotel and casino, of course, and he was mafia connected. All of the big hotels that were being built in the late 1950s, almost all of them were mafia-built hotels, and they had investments from very legitimate banks, corporations, and other investors. So the U.S. government was a little outraged when they were simply thrown out, lock, stock, and barrel. And then, as we now know, the mafia worked with the Kennedy brothers to assassinate Castro in 1960, 61, 62. And there's ample testimony to this. So, yes, there was a sort of partnership. I don't know what you call it. You know, the Kennedys, or President Kennedy, somebody called him a simulopter. That is, he would take two different, including polar opposite positions, to resolve any given issue. So it was assassinate Castro or negotiate with Castro, whichever one turns out. I guess that's what you call the extreme immorality of politics.
Well, there's another thing that I didn't know about. There's a lot in this film I didn't know about, which was this collaboration between the CIA and the Catholic Church at a certain point to separate Cuban children from their parents so that these children could be raised in the United States.
That's right. This was sort of outrageous, and one of the organizers of it testifies in the film, Antonio Veciana. He was one of the people who helped forge this phony law. The phony law said the Cuban state is now going to take over all the indoctrination and education of the children. It will remove parental control. This was a law that was forged essentially by the CIA, and it was circulated amongst wealthy Cubans. And many of them believed it and said, oh, we're going to lose control of our children's minds. We'd better get them out. And the church and the CIA collaborated in this. And, in fact, a very, very well-known professor at the University of New Mexico, he's now emeritus, Nelson Valdez, who was in the film, was one of these children called the Peter Pan Kids, because that was the name of the operation that the CIA gave. They called it Peter Pan. So they got almost 15,000 kids, almost all, you know, upper middle and upper class kids, out of Cuba. It was a brain drain operation. It was a destabilization attempt by the CIA with a collaboration of officials of the church.
Now, in 1961, Che Guevara was sent to negotiate, diplomatic negotiations with the United States. It seemed like Cuba made, with Che Guevara, made a reasonable offer. What happened?
Well, what happened after the loss at the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy brothers were outraged. I think Fidel made a little mistake here, too. He told me in one of the off-camera interviews that I did with him for a documentary film that I was doing for CBS. He said, you know, had I been a little older or more mature, I would have known, you know, how to act more humble in victory. I think he was referring to the idea that he paraded the prisoners on camera on Cuban television, which was like, you know, a slap in Kennedy's face after he was defeated. Anyway, the Kennedys were angry, and they revved up the covert war. That is, the CIA was launching several attacks a day on Cuban coastal areas. They were assassinating militiamen, volunteer teachers. They were burning cane fields and attacking industrial facilities. And the Cubans couldn't defend it. And so Fidel, I think, probably in desperation, sent Che Guevara to have a secret meeting with Richard Goodwin, who was Kennedy's Latin America advisor. And they met at midnight, as Goodwin tells the story, in an apartment in Uruguay. And Che essentially laid out the three things that were bothering the United States. He said, all right, we will cut back drastically on our military cooperation with the Soviet Union. We will stop what you call exporting revolution to Latin America, and we will work out some deal to compensate the American companies that were expropriated by the revolution. In return, you restore commercial relations and essentially leave us alone.
Which seems perfectly reasonable.
Yes. Goodwin came back to Washington, and Kennedy asked him for his recommendation. The story Goodwin tells is that Che also sent him a box of Monte Cristo No. 1s, Kennedy's choice cigar at the time. And Kennedy lit one up, and he said, "You know, Goodwin, by all rights, you should have smoked the first one," referring to one of the plots that the CIA had planned against Castro, which was a poison cigar plot. Anyway, Goodwin's advice was, well, you know, I think that the Cuban proposal shows weakness, and we could probably better turn up the heat. And Kennedy said that was his inclination as well, and that's what they did. They turned up the heat. So the raids, the CIA raids against Cuba, today we would call those raids terrorism. That is, when a boat comes along and machine guns the harbor or fires cannons at a particular target or drops a crew of saboteurs to bomb or set fire to an installation. This we would call terrorism, right? In that those days it was called fighting for freedom. Anyway, this led Castro to his ultra-desperate act, that is, he authorized the Soviet Union to put in medium-range ballistic missiles with nuclear warheads and medium-range Soviet bombers. And that led the world to probably its scariest moment in all human history, the missile crisis of October 1962.
We're talking to Saul Landau about his film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? So, as we know, we didn't all die in nuclear war in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it was resolved diplomatically, but the U.S. did not keep up its end of the bargain.
Well, it didn't, in the sense that Kennedy made Khrushchev a promise that he would let Cuba alone and drop all the plans to invade Cuba. Well, he may have not planned an invasion of Cuba, but he was sure not letting Cuba alone. The hostilities continued in two kinds of operations. The CIA has always wonderful names for these operations. One was called Mongoose, and this was an operation whereby the CIA directed Cuban exiles, gave them explosives and weapons, and sent them to hit particular targets. And these included assassination attempts. One of them, by Antonio Veciana, is detailed in the film. There were others that came later. The other one was even worse. It was called autonomous operations, whereby the CIA would provide weapons, explosives, boats, planes, and money to Cuban exile groups bent on attacking Cuba without knowing what their targets were. This, as the CIA officer who ran the program, Sam Halpern, said, this was bad tradecraft. But this was the operations of the U.S. government that ran through 1962 and up through parts of 1963. I think until Kennedy made his famous American University speech in the fall of 63, just before he was assassinated, the policy was essentially very aggressive.
Now, a culture of gangsterism and terrorism arose in Miami with bombings in Miami on the level of Belfast. Who was trying to achieve what, and why was there so little response on the part of U.S. law enforcement?
Well, the American government and U.S. government agencies were caught in a bind. The people who were carrying out these bombings and terrorist attacks, some of them were shootings or arson, were the very people they had trained and promised that they were going to go back to Cuba and free their island from communism. And they didn't do it. That is, Kennedy did not do it at the Bay of Pigs, and then he didn't do it at the missile crisis. Both times, in the Cuban right-wing exile mind, chickened out. And they wanted the United States government to do what they wanted them to do at first. Then the bombings inside the United States came to be a means of raising funds. You got a nice store here, you know? And if you don't pay me the extortion money, you know what's going to happen to the store. So people who would oppose them, who would go on the radio, for example, and say terrorism is stupid, it's not only inhumane, but it's not a policy that's going to win, these people got bombed. Or people with whom they were having vendettas or who were vying for control of their particular underground exile group. So that the bombings became widespread, and when the U.S. law enforcement began to try to crack down on them, they bombed the FBI building, they bombed the post offices, and so on. Saying, oh, yeah, you You were the ones who taught us. You were the ones who encouraged us. Now we're going to show you what we'll do to you. And this activity continued. I was personally involved in several of these rather unpleasant incidents. The first one, when my documentary film, Fidel, was to show on public television. This was 69. And the Cuban exiles warned public television, if you put this on, you're going to get bombed. The Miami station did not run it. The New York station did run it and got bombed. Fortunately, nobody died. When my film then had its theatrical release at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in New York City, before the curtain went up, the theater was bombed. And that was the end of its theatrical run in New York, but we were going to open it in Los Angeles. The day before, however, the theater was burned down. So this was my first direct taste. Later, my film was going to be shown at the Center for Cuban Studies in New York, and there was a bomb placed there. Luckily, the director had gone to the bathroom and didn't die. In the film, one of the victims of this bombing, Max Lesnik, who was critical of terrorism, living in Miami, and he had a radio show, and he also ran a magazine, and he was bombed 8 times. And he asked the question, you know, they say they want to overthrow the government in Havana, but they're putting bombs in Miami. I don't see the logic. Well, the logic is, if these terrorists are going to make a living, how are they going to make a living? Other than by showing how strong and tough they are, so people won't ask questions when they come and say, you got a nice store here, or you got a lovely looking home here, or, you know, your grandchildren are so cute looking. Everybody's now seen The Sopranos, and they understand this language.
Right. It's such a classic case of how violence breeds violence, and how if a government starts down a path of violence and then decide to change course, it's not so easy.
No, it isn't. And it's, you know, it's always important to say, when you outline a policy, find somebody who's saying, would you lay me out the worst-case scenario for this policy, please? It's oftentimes Americans don't do that, Americans in office. They just don't ask questions. You know, when you decide, like, say, oh, let's use drones and hunt down the terrorists with the drones, and then, oops, one of the drones happened to kill a bunch of women and children. Oh, well, collateral damage. Well, maybe the relatives of those dead women and children don't think so, and we've now multiplied our enemies and taught them, by the way, how to attack. I mean, how hard is it to take one of those, you know, little model airplanes and fill them with, these days, everybody somehow, not me, fortunately, I'm not interested, everyone seems to be able to learn how to make explosives. It's ridiculous. When you start a policy like this, it can come back and haunt you. And this is exactly what happened in Cuba. So terrorism infested the streets of Miami. It got to the streets of New York. And in 1976, it hit 3/4 of a mile from the White House when a group of extreme right-wing Cuban exiles, now working for the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, detonated a bomb under the car of the former Chilean ambassador to Washington, Orlando Letelier. And in the car was traveling Ronnie Moffatt, a 25-year-old woman who was his colleague, and her husband. The bombing blew off Letelier's legs and killed Moffatt as well, Ronnie Moffatt. And, Betty Ford could have been taking a stroll right there, 3/4 of a mile from the White House on Embassy Row on Massachusetts Avenue. And at this time, this was the worst case of terrorism in Washington. Audacious. Cuban exiles did the job. So it became the way they made their living, the way they made their reputation led them to make their living. It was extortion. And that's what it got for us. I mean, now it's really hard to argue that terrorism is a good policy. But, you know, I have to tell you, Mary Charlotte, that I think some of these guys, in between visits to their proctologists and gerontologists, are still plotting.
We're talking to Saul Landau about his film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? Within all of this, I mean, when you think about the amount of anger and firepower total impunity from the U.S. government that these groups had, and the fact that the U.S. government was continually trying to overthrow Cuba, trying to overthrow Castro, all the assassination attempts against Castro failed. Every other attempt, U.S. government and terrorist, all failed to overthrow Castro. How could this possibly be?
Well, I don't know. You know, the Babalaos and the Santeros in the Santeria religion think that Fidel is some kind of magic. He has some kind of god status. I unfortunately don't believe in that. I think he was lucky on the one hand, and I think, and this is crucial for the film, he had very good intelligence. That is, he began sending people in to infiltrate and penetrate at a very early age. And using this intelligence that they got out of this, they were able to prevent an awful lot of these assassinations. And I think that's essentially, plus, of course, obvious luck, what saved him. He told me one story in one of our film journeys. I made altogether four films with him for CBS and for public television. He said the closest he ever came was the poison milkshake plot, in which a woman who he knew, actually, brought in what he called a very pernicious poison, which she hid in her cold cream jar as she came through customs. And then she passed this little poison pellet, which was made in the CIA lab, to the guy who ran the milkshake bar at the Havana Libre Hotel. That used to be the Havana Hilton. Fidel at the time had sort of an addiction to chocolate milkshakes, and he'd stop in 3-4 times a week to get one. And the guy who ran the milkshake bar hid the poison right next to the carton of chocolate ice cream in the freezer. And sure enough, Fidel came in, ordered his usual, and he went down to scoop out the ice cream, but when he went to remove the poison, it had frozen fast to the side of the freezer. And he was having real trouble getting it out, and of course, Fidel's bodyguards began to get a little suspicious, so he had to just abandon the plan. Later on, apparently the woman told, they found the poison in the freezer, arrested the bartender. Fidel said that was the closest he came.
Tell us about Brothers to the Rescue. They actually did start out as a rescue group for people escaping from Cuba on rafts. What happened after that?
Yes. Well, in 1991, a whole bunch of Cuban rafters hit the water, because there were no jobs in Cuba. Cuba was at its lowest point. The Soviet Union had disappeared. There was no work. There was little food. The Cuban economy was in a very drastic downward spiral. And some of these rafters were getting into trouble in the 90-mile or more distance with sharks and with weather and currents and so on. And so Brothers to the Rescue, organized by Jose Basulto, began to fly over this area and radio the positions of the rafters to nearby ships, who would then pick them up. When the United States and Cuba signed a migration accord in which the Cubans who were picked up at sea were returned to the island or to Guantanamo, Brothers to the Rescue lost its function. Now, how were they going to make a living, if you like? And so Basulto changed his mission and began to fly Brothers to the Rescue overflights of Cuban airspace. And they were dropping leaflets onto Havana and other points. The Cuban government complained adamantly, vociferously to Washington, and at a certain point warned the United States government that one more overflight would result, and this was told to me personally, in the gravest of consequences. And that's pretty clear what they were talking about. Earlier in the film, I think we had a point where Eisenhower received the complaints of the Cuban government, said to the Secretary of State, well, why don't the Cubans just shoot them down? Well, the American government did not stop the next overflight by Brothers to the Rescue, and two of the planes were shot down, resulting in the death of two co-pilots and two pilots. And this froze Cuban relations and ultimately led to the arrest of the Cuban Five and to the incarceration of them. One of them, Gerardo Hernandez, who was the control man in the group, was charged with aiding and abetting because he was said to have sent the information on when the flights were going to take place, as if, A, he knew that information as a secret, and, B, that he knew that the Cuban government had made a decision to shoot him down. here he was a relatively low or middle level at best spy, and the trial assumed that, of course, he knew the decisions that were made at the very top of the government. In any case, the planes were shot down. Cuban-U.S. relations froze, or got worse. Clinton signed the Helms-Burton bill, tightening the embargo. And the Brothers to the Rescue paid the ultimate... Brothers to the Rescue disappeared, and the Cuban Five paid the ultimate price, long, long prison sentences, under very harsh and bad conditions. And as... Well, Colonel Wilkerson, who was at the... who became Colin Powell's chief of staff, he said that they had the same chance of a fair trial in Miami as a Israeli spy would have in Tehran. I would say that, you know, my comparison would have been a Jew in Berlin in 1939.
Right. Well, and the fact that the U.S. did not accept Cuba's right to control its own airspace. I mean, it's one of the people in your film says, hey, if Cuban citizens were flying airplanes without permission over Washington, D.C., they'd be shot down in a minute. And it was as if these Brothers to the Rescue were extensions of the U.S. government. That's how that case was treated.
Exactly. And it was treated that way because of the power of the anti-Castro lobby. And that's crucial in this country. I think, you know, there is one group that doesn't have a strong lobby in this country. That's the American people. But every other single interest group has a strong lobby and usually gets what it wants. And in this case, they really got what they wanted. They essentially run U.S.-Cuba policy. And, you know, you can't compare them to the NRA or to the health insurance lobby, but boy, in their own sphere, they are extremely powerful and have essentially taken control of much of the policy. And I think the film demonstrates how powerful they are. At the end, you see their congresswoman speaking. I assume you were a little bit shocked by that part.
Well, the whole film, I mean, the contrast between the Cuban Five, who were living multiple life sentences in solitary confinement, horrible prison conditions, for basically trying to stop bombings against stop terrorism against their own people. You have that, and then the contrast between that and the Cuban terrorists walking around free in Miami. I understood watching this film more clearly than ever that these people walking around in Miami are full-on terrorists, comparable to any terrorist group in the world. They are equivalent to Muslim terrorists, Irish terrorists, name your terrorist.
Well, when two of them plotted to knock down a Cuban commercial airliner in 1976, and killed all 73 passengers and crew members. You ask, well, why would anybody want to do that? I mean, what use is that other than to show, boy, are we audacious, and boy, are we bloodthirsty? Other than that, what have they shown? This is not going to knock down the Cuban government. It's going to kill 73 people. That's what they did. One of them just died, Orlando Bosch. Shortly before he died, he was honored at the University of Miami for his role in trying to restore freedom and democracy to Cuba. Luis Posada Carriles, his co-author of that, or co-mastermind of that bombing, is honored regularly in Miami. And the U.S. government, despite declassified cables now that show the U.S. government knew all about the plan to do this, and has solid evidence, including the two people he hired to put the explosive on the airplane. They both testified that he'd hired them to do it. He walks around as a free man in the streets of Miami, and he is regularly honored in that city. In fact, he was given the keys to the city of Hialeah by the mayor of the city and the city council. And ironically, no reporter said, could you tell me exactly what he did, right, to restore democracy and freedom in Cuba? Nobody asks that question. I can't think of anything he's done to do that. I mean, other than if you think killing people, innocent civilians in an airplane, is going to somehow do that, well, again, I don't see the logic. But this is it. You hit it on the head, Mary Charlotte. These people are, under any definition of the word, terrorists.
So as you say, a lot of these older guys are either very old or gone. And many of the hardcore Cubans, even who weren't terrorists, who left after the revolution, are gone. How does the younger generation feel? Where are we now politically regarding Miami Cubans?
Well, I think there's been a real shift with the various migrations that have occurred since the early days, beginning in 1980, and especially in the 90s and in the 21st century. You now have a new group of Cuban Americans who are not out to kill members of their family, who are not out to do this kind of stupid stuff. And I think you're going to begin to see that, maybe if not in the next election, then in the one after it. The old guard has milked out of this anti-Castroism, I think, as much as it could probably get. There's no point to it. If the United States, and anybody who's been to Cuba and studied anything knows this, if the United States really wanted to see a change in Cuba, as it says it does, it would lift the embargo by introducing huge amounts of American capital and millions of American tourists. You would change literally overnight. You would change that country. So that's the real route. Punishing Cuba, which is the policy of the anti-Castro lobby, doesn't really punish them. It punishes the poorest people on the island. That's all. The very people they say they want to help. It doesn't turn them against Castro. It turns them more against this group of extremists, who are, many of them, benefiting in one way or another economically from this embargo. So there you have it. And Washington seems to be eternally paralyzed. I mean, I'm optimistic. I think the embargo is going to be lifted, I would say, by the year 2050.
That's a long time away. I mean, my understanding is that the reality of Florida being a swing state and wanting to get the Miami vote is really the more operative concern on the part of Washington than Cuban-American relationships or the welfare of the Cuban people.
Yes. I mean, President Obama was going to do things in Latin America. He promised, and when he went down to Trinidad in April of 2009, and he said new policies, hasn't done them. I'm sure you're shocked about that, but he just hasn't done them. He's done one good thing. He's removed the restrictions from Cuban Americans to travel so that they can go and see their families and give them some more money. And he's made it a little bit easier for Americans to go down there. For example, if you wanted to go, you would have no problem traveling on what's called a general license. You are a radio professional, and you would go down as that. You would not need to apply for a license. So any professional who has professional reasons to go can simply go under what's called general license. But we still have this ridiculous embargo as the Cubans are exploring for deep water oil and the oil companies are drooling, as the Cubans are a really nice little market for American agricultural goods and could be a much bigger market if we would allow them to have some credit and buy some of their stuff. The embargo remains. The whole world opposes it. The United Nations General Assembly votes usually 187-3 every single year to condemn the embargo, but it doesn't seem to matter. This is the result of the lobby and of, there's a sentiment that somehow has stuck in the walls of the national security offices in Washington and osmotically oozes into the brains of the new people who occupy those offices at every presidential transition. And this says the Cubans have, Fidel Castro has the world record. He's in the Guinness Book of Records for disobedience, and we just can't let him get away with it without punishing him. And that, I think, combined with the efforts of the Cuban lobby, are the two factors that explain U.S. policy. I mean, there's also, you know, worries of competition, I guess, from Florida tobacco and Florida sugar and Florida citrus. But I think those are relatively minor.
How did you make the film? How did you get all those interviews with right-wing Cubans who presumably know the kind of films that you make?
Well, I don't know, frankly. I mean, other people did the interview, except for Vesiana. Other people did the interviews. My daughter interviewed Basulto. Another woman interviewed Orlando Bosch, and a woman we hired also interviewed Posada. Yes, I would be known, and I could very well likely have been shot on the spot if I had showed up. So we hired other people to do those. Vesiana, however, did a long interview with me, and it was a very interesting one. And he's the only one who is now, well, he wants to atone, I think, for some of the things that he did. And he says so in the film.
That was a very moving moment late in the film where this man who had spent, what, 40 or 50 years plotting actively to overthrow Cuba and engaging a lot of really violent actions in one way or another, said, all we have done is accomplish nothing and sow more hatred and division.
Yes, and I think he's, you know, but he is a man that has his conscience has bitten him, I think, and he's also been reflective about his life, and it's very rare that that happens. And I think he's, how should I say, more sensitive than the others, clearly.
Yeah.
And I respect him, and I think he's become an honest man. I don't think he's ever dishonest, but I think that he's now a more sensitive and admirable figure. There were so many good stories that we couldn't put in the film from so many of the interviews we had, or some we couldn't use, some characters we couldn't use at all. Stories about secret meetings that Henry Kissinger set up with representatives of Castro, stories of how Cyrus Vance planned to end the embargo. These kind of stories that just didn't find their way into the film because it would have made it too long and too complicated. But we had an interesting learning experience doing the film.
There's a subtext that the film didn't really explore, but it was obvious to me watching it that every Miami Cuban was white, and many of the Cubans who stayed behind and supported Castro were Afro-Cubans. How do you observe the whole issue of race in the politics of Cuba and Cuban exiles?
Well, see, in Cuba, the word Afro-Cuban makes no sense, since more than half of the island are black, would be considered black people. Maybe 65-70% would be simply, today, here they would call African-Americans or blacks. In Cuba, African doesn't make sense because almost all Cubans have African heritage, so they'd all be Afro-Cubans. I mean, there's almost nobody that hasn't been touched by it. So, yes, there were very few blacks among the exiles, the militant exiles, very few. And that does tell you something, and you were very, I think, perceptive in picking it up. And it was a subtext that we didn't want to go into, but it was there in the film, as was the stuff on the streets. At the end, we show all those shots of Cuban streets. It's just life, great people living their lives. In this, brutal communist dictatorship, you don't see a lot of cops on the street. You don't see soldiers on the street. If you go to Mexico City, you go to any store, you have guys armed with elephant guns. To Sanborns, the famous drugstore chain in Mexico City, there are two guards in every store armed with these enormous weapons. Everywhere you look, there are armed people. Or Chile, and most of Latin America, full of armed people. With uniforms. You don't see it in Cuba. I'm not saying Cuba's an ideal democracy, don't get me wrong. But it is not a state that is under threat from its own people. And the reason really is that, first of all, Fidel Castro, I think he could have written a chapter in Machiavelli's The Prince of how do you deal with your enemies. His answer was you export them to your larger enemy, and that's what he did. He exported almost all of the people who opposed him are now in Florida. And in Florida, they really don't have much say about what goes on in Cuba. The lesson to the United States is, don't import your enemy's enemies. I don't know what else to say, but I mean, that would, to my mind, be the motto. So here, what is the United States selling to Cuba? We're going to say that it's really much better to have health insurance companies than it is to just have across the board free access to medicine, absolutely free. It's much better to pay $40,000 a year tuition for your kid than it is to have free university education up to a PhD. Or it builds character if you have to pay rent or a mortgage payment every month rather than own your own home, right? These are hard sells, I would say, in Cuba, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and what's really striking, I mean, I've been to Cuba quite a number of times, and I've never met anybody who, and I've I mean, some people don't want to talk, but I've never met anybody who has hostility toward Americans. They distinguish very clearly and easily between Americans and American policy, and they may be against American policy, but it's not even a violent opposition. It's more along the lines of, why can't we all just kind of be rational about this and do the right thing?
Yeah, I think you're right. The Cubans are, you know, they've been, there's big changes going on there now, but they've been a very spoiled people in a certain way. They've been very protected. They don't know what it is to get fired or to get laid off. They don't know what it is to be homeless. They don't know what it is to be hungry. They were for a while when there was this real shortage of food, but basically, the Cubans are very protected. You don't have the kind of fear that you have if you go out in certain cities. I live across, right across a little body of water from Oakland, California. It's really brutal out there in certain parts of Oakland at night. There's almost a murder every night. You don't have that in Havana. You have passion killings, maybe, you know, domestic kind of stuff. But you don't have this kind of brutal stuff going on that we have in this country or in much of the world.
Right. Now, so, very different
Cubans
culture.
Are protected. Yeah.
Is there, at this point in history, where the United States has so much money and ideology wrapped up in anti-terrorism, is there any anti-terrorism law enforcement energy going toward Cuban terrorism at this point?
Well, if there is, it's a very well-guarded secret. I'm not saying there isn't, but I don't think that's exactly where they're looking. They don't really consider it terrorism. And it's what it does is hold this country up to ridicule in the rest of the world. People see Luis Posada Carriles, who bombed the Cuban airline. It was known to the CIA, known to the president, known to all of the top people in the country. He walks around as a free man in what is more and more called the Autonomous Republic of Miami. And nothing is done to arrest him or stop him or deport him. Venezuelans are asking for his extradition because he plotted the bombing in Caracas. Nope. He'll be tortured if he goes to Venezuela, albeit there's not an iota of evidence for that. Anyway, they have all kinds of rationales. They don't work. We lose prestige. We lose respect by having this kind of policy. We're waging a war on terrorism, except certain kinds of terrorists are good guys. They're not terrorists. They're freedom fighters. We have three kinds. We've classified them. We have the good, the bad, and the crazy. The good terrorists are sending drones and bombing people in North Waziristan, whoever the hell they are. And the good terrorists are sending drones to Yemen and Somalia and so on. And the good terrorists are dropping bombs on, how should I say it, hospitals in Libya and so on. These are good terrorists because we're fighting for humanitarian reasons, for democracy, for freedom. And the terrorists who bomb a Cuban airliner or shoot down Cubans or bomb them, they are well-intentioned terrorists. The bad terrorists clearly are Muslims. And the crazy terrorists are like the guy in Sweden or McVeigh and Nickel who did the Oklahoma bombing. They don't get explained very well, especially those that are Christians. But anyway, those are the three categories we have. And we're only interested in the bad terrorists, and those are all connected in one way or another to Islam these days. It doesn't sit well with thinking people.
Saul Landau is an award-winning filmmaker. He's made over 40 films, and he's producer, director, and writer of the new film, Will the Real Terrorist Please Stand Up? It screens at 7:30 on Monday, the 22nd of August, at the CCA here in Santa Fe. And you will be there in person. We look forward to meeting you.
Well, I look forward to meeting people who come to see the film, and I'll be there to answer questions at the end. And I think there are going to even be DVDs of the film available.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to having you, and thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.